You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm pretty sure this is going to be a terrific interview and maybe even the best one ever. But that's the way I generally approach every guest. Am I atypical, or are humans genetically predisposed to see the glass half full? In her new book, The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain, neuroscientist Tali Sharot explores the positive Darwinian consequences of this state of mind. It is published by Pantheon Press, and I'm very pleased, in fact, very, 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 very happy that it's brought Tali Sharot to our show today. Hello.
Hi, good to be here.
Do you think that this is going to be as good for you as it will be for me?
The show? Absolutely.
Why do you say that hope isn't rational? Doesn't it depend on past experiences? If things in a certain area have usually turned out well, shouldn't we assume that they're going to be good the next time, and vice versa? If they've been bad in the past, it's only reasonable to be pessimistic.
Yeah, it's true. But what we find is that people are a little bit overly optimistic, which means that they expect things to be a bit better than they end up being. And one reason this is because we tend to learn more from positive information than negative information. So, for example, in an experiment that we've done back in London, we gave people information about the likelihood of getting all kinds of medical illnesses. And we found that people would take information that's better than expected. For example, if we told them Alzheimer's, there's a 10% chance in the population to get Alzheimer's, and if they thought the average likelihood is higher than that, they would say, oh, well, this is interesting, and they updated their belief straight away. But if we gave them information that was worse than what they expected, for example, we told them cancer is on average about 30% in the population to suffer from cancer. And if this was higher than what they expected, they disregarded this. They didn't change their beliefs. So it's true that people should really learn, but I think that the learning seems to be biased.
Well, I heard a report this morning that 95% of all scientists believe that we are experiencing climate change, but only 60% of Americans believe it.
Yeah, I think that's another great example. You know, when we hear information that will make us pessimistic rather than optimistic, it's really tough to get that message across. And we found using brain imaging that it's the brain. So the brain shows great encoding of information when the information is desirable about the future, but less efficiently encodes information that is worse.
Well, optimism is often denigrated in our society, isn't it? Aren't optimists often dismissed as being Pollyannas?
Well, the funny thing is that optimism is a bit of an illusion. So you're not aware of your own optimism. So I get a lot of people into my lab saying, oh, I'm a realist, you know. And, you know, people, I guess a lot of people want to be seen as a realist. And then I do the tests on them, and they're just as optimistic as everyone else. I think that's an important thing for optimism to really work. Maybe we need to be unaware of it.
But don't we also tend to value darker views as more honest and more valuable? And in the arts, that's definitely true. We're more likely to go see Hamlet and Lear than we are. Well, maybe we do like a comedy once in a while, but the darker ones are the ones that have survived longer.
Yeah, absolutely. The optimism bias is all about expectations about the future. It doesn't mean that everyone's happy. It doesn't mean that we only like good feel movies and good feel books. That's not the case at all. It simply means that we have a biased perception of what's going to happen.
Should we make a distinction between optimism and confidence?
I think they are somewhat related. There is a tendency for people to be overconfident. Also, there's a tendency of people to, it's called the better than average effect. So people tend to think they're better than average on all sorts of different abilities and characteristics. For example, if you have people rate themselves on whether they're good at getting along with others, you find that 25% of the population put themselves at the top 1%. Or driving ability, 93% of the population put themselves above average. And this is true when you ask people how interesting or how modest or honest they are. Most people put themselves above average. And of course, statistically, this is not possible.
How did you stumble on this optimist bias?
So it was all an accident. What I was trying to do back in the day was to try and see if the same brain structures that are important in our ability to recollect the past are also important for our ability to imagine the future. There was some evidence to suggest that the two abilities are related and they use the same neural systems. So I conducted an experiment in which I had volunteers come into my lab, and I gave them specific events to recall from the past and specific events to imagine in the future. At that point, something very surprising happened. Even when I gave my volunteers mundane, boring, everyday events to imagine, such as getting a haircut or flying on a plane, they would imagine these magnificent scenarios around them. They always imagined the best possible scenario. So, for example, for having a haircut, one person said, I imagine going to getting my haircut and donating my hair to Locks of Love, which is a charity, and then celebrating with my friends. Or for taking a flight, someone imagined having a very peaceful flight. The flight would arrive on time. She would sleep all the way. So it was always this kind of like magnificent, positive scenario. And this was quite unexpected to me. And that's how I really started to get interested in the optimism bias.
Of course, and two members of a family are aware of the fact that if you ask about memories of something in the past, you're going to get very different responses. What is a flashbulb memory?
Right. So that's what I was investigating at the time. A flashbulb memory is memories for very, very emotional, arousing events, such as, for example, if you try to recall now the events of 9/11. So try to think of where you were, what you were doing. What happens is that when you recall these events, they tend to be very vivid. So you imagine them with great detail and great confidence. Again, we have this confidence that our memory happened exactly the way that we thought it did. And it's called a flashbulb memory because it feels like a videotape, a replay of what happened. Interestingly enough, it tends not to be as accurate as we think it is. So an experiment done in Duke University, they had students come in just after 9/11 and write down what happened to them that day. And they also wrote what happened to them a couple of days ago, a couple of days before 9/11, which was just a normal day. They did their laundry, went to class, whatever. And then they had the students come back a few days later, a few weeks later, a few months later, a few years later. And what they found was that the memories of these students for 9/11 were not more accurate than memories of just a regular day, but they were more vivid, more confident. The students were quite sure that it happened the way it did, but as you say, it wasn't necessarily true.
But does it help if there's a trigger like Proust's Madeleine? Or
a trigger for your memory, a
yes.
cue?
Because sometimes I'll be walking down the street and there'll be a smell, and the next thing I know, just as Proust would have written it, a whole forgotten experience of my childhood unfolds before me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I forget it again.
Absolutely. There's what we call recollection. So if you have a cue, it's easier to recollect an event that maybe you think you had forgotten. But in this case, it's not that people have the sense of forgetting. No, they have a very, very strong sense of recollection. It's just that the memory is not as accurate as we think it is.
Does the brain use the same structures to remember the past as to imagine the future?
Yes. So that is quite an interesting finding, that the same structures that are involved in recollecting the past are involved in imagining the future. And it's maybe not surprising because the two tasks are very similar. You can call it mental time travel, and we do this all day, all the time. We think about what we had for dinner yesterday, what we did the week before, a vacation a year ago, and then we think about, you know, what we're going to do tonight and what we're going to do next week, and we keep traveling back and forth. We can even imagine what will happen years and years from now, and we can even imagine what will happen after we're not here, or what happened before we actually were here. So.
Now, your background is Israeli, American, and now British. Would all of these things be the same in every country, or are there certain things that are more likely to be American, for example? Because we often think of Americans as being more optimistic than other people.
Yeah, a lot of people think that Americans are optimistic, and you know, Obama invented optimism. But that's not the case. I have done experiments, as you said. I've done experiments in Israel, in England, in Germany, in the U.S., and other researchers have done experiments on optimism in different countries. And optimism is something that you find in every country that has been looked at so far. So there's no evidence so far that Americans are different from anyone else, but there hasn't been a comparison to actually look at that.
My guest is Tali Sharot. Her book, The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain, is published by Pantheon. Well, how does this help us get through the idea that death is inevitable?
Yeah, so there was a suggestion by some evolutionary biologist, an evolutionary biologist at UC San Diego, that suggests that when humans first became conscious, so they became aware of what may happen to them in the future, they had the ability to look forward, and then they actually had the ability to understand that their time is limited here, and understand that death awaits, and old age awaits, and a lot of things that are somewhat negative. At that point, the suggestion is that the fear and anguish would have been so severe that humans would have not been able to actually commit the actions needed to continue surviving. And in order to continue surviving, the suggestion is that consciousness had to develop side by side with positive illusions. So the awareness of death had to develop together with its denial for the human race to continue and develop.
You begin your book with a description of a flight from Cairo to Paris that disappears from the radar in 2004. Can you talk about that for a moment? Was it flying under challenging circumstances?
The reason I give that example is I want to make the point that the optimism bias is an illusion. It's a trick of the brain like many others. So it's just one trick that the brain plays of us, but the brain plays a lot of different tricks on us. And I start with this illusion, which is vertigo, so that pilots experience sometimes that they feel they're going down when they're actually going up. They feel that they're going right while they're actually going left. And this, of course, can be very dangerous. But pilots have the mechanisms on the plane to make sure that they can know where they're going. But the point is that their feeling of what reality is, the feeling of which direction they're going, does not correspond to where they're actually going.
So do they second-guess their own instruments on the plane?
No, they're trained not to. This is important. It's one of the first things that pilots are trained to do. They're trained to learn that they should trust the instruments rather than their own instincts. And in that case of the flight going from Cairo, the pilot did not notice the instruments, and he was going according to his own instincts, and unfortunately that plane fell into the ocean.
And we've heard of other cases where they were pulling the plane up instead of down or vice versa. But once we're informed of the illusion, does the illusion disappear?
No, so it doesn't. And we're on radio, so I can't show you very nice optical illusions. But I think those are the most powerful in showing people that what you see and how you perceive the world is not really how it always is. And if you're looking at my book, you can see a few of these optical illusions. And the optimism and the optical illusions, when I show you how they unfold, you still see them as faulty. So you see reality not as it really is. And the same thing is with the optimism bias. I can explain to you and show you all the evidence, scientific evidence that suggests that humans are optimistic. And, you know, I think a lot of people will believe me after looking at all the evidence. However, they remain optimistic. The illusion is not shattered.
For ourselves or for everyone? For example, when you ask people to rate themselves and they rated themselves obviously disproportionately high, would they rate other people disproportionately high?
No. So the optimism bias and the superiority illusion as well, it's something that we have about ourselves. So we are optimistic about ourselves. We're optimistic about our kids and our families, but we're somewhat pessimistic about the country. We're pessimistic about our fellow citizens and sometimes about our leaders. It's what's called private optimism, but public despair.
Tali Sharot, T-A-L-I-S-H-A-R-O-T. Her book, The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain, published by Pantheon. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Tali Sharot, her book, The Optimism Bias, a tour of the irrationally positive brain. It's published by Pantheon. Are humans the only species who can imagine the future?
That's a good question, a question that's very, very hard to answer because obviously you can't ask animals, you know, what they imagine in the future.
But we put them through tests, don't
yeah.
we?
Well, and, yeah, but it's so much more difficult, obviously. I mean, I have the easy part of the game here. I bring humans into my lab and I just ask them whatever I want and I get the answers. But scientists who study animals, they have much tougher task. But there has been some very good studies on animals, on birds, and on mice, showing that they might have optimistic biases as well, that they might have positive illusions. They use very sophisticated methods to show that, and it shows that the animals expect positive events, even if there is no real evidence and no reason for them to do so. So from that studies, and my intuition is that we're not the only ones.
Why do you say that the answer to how some birds learn to time travel can be found in the brains of London taxi drivers?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting. There's a lot of studies on birds by Nikki Clayton, who's in Cambridge University.
And they turn out to be a lot smarter than we thought. Bird brain shouldn't be an insult.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. They can remember. So what they do, they hide their food. And they hide their food in hundreds of different places. And then they come back months later and they remember where they put the different pieces of food. Not only that, they're quite sophisticated in that if they see another bird watching them while they hide food, they then come back later, take out the food from where they hid it and put it somewhere else so that the other bird won't come and get that food. So they're very, very sophisticated animals. And they seem to have some kind of understanding that there is a tomorrow. So, for example, if they are in one room with lots of food and they usually wake up in another room where there isn't food, they would take the food from one room to the other room ahead of time. So then when they wake up the next morning, they have breakfast. So
that. Which parts of the brains do all of this? Is this hippocampus like everything else seems to be?
Well, it's not everything, but yeah. So going back to your cab driver question, what these birds have is that they have a very developed hippocampus. And the hippocampus is part of the brain that's involved in memory and also in imagining the future. And quite interestingly, the bird's hippocampus grows and shrinks throughout the year. So it's different, not all birds, specific species. But in cab drivers, you find the same thing. So cab drivers, this is a study done by Eleanor McGuire in London. And what she found was that the hippocampus of London cab drivers is a bit larger than the rest of us. However, after they retire, it shrinks back to the original size. So it's something that it's not necessarily that they were born with this large hippocampus. It kind of like changes on the job.
And in that case, it's because they have to remember such complicated routes to
exactly.
get everywhere?
Yeah, just like the birds, they have to navigate in London. And navigating in London is not as easy as navigating in New York. So they have to remember, and they have to take very difficult tests in order to become taxi drivers. Some people take the test 6 times until they actually, or more, until they pass it. So they have to have this what's called the knowledge of London streets.
A listener, Henry in New Jersey, asks, aren't the memories of traumatic events in a class by themselves as far as accuracy is concerned?
Yes. Well, traumatic as is emotional. So very emotional events. When we recall these events, different parts of the brain are involved than when we recall just neutral events. And this is something that we found when we had individuals who were in New York City on 9/11. We had them come to our lab 3 years later and we scanned their brain. We looked at the function of their brain while they recalled the events of that day. And what we found was that the part of the brain called the amygdala, which is important for emotional processing, that part of the brain was very much active when people recalled the events of 9/11. And the closer the person was to the World Trade Center at the time, the more activity we found in the amygdala. And you don't really find amygdala activation if you're recalling neutral events. It's only when you're recalling emotional events. And it seems that people rely on the signal from the amygdala to try and guess how valid their memories are.
Now, when athletes predict the outcome of a game, usually they predict we're going to win. Are they just being optimistic, or does it actually affect the way they play?
Yeah, so optimism can be a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The idea
so
is
when
that
Joe Namath said the Jets were going to win the Super Bowl, or Pat Riley predicted that the Celtics would beat the Lakers for the NBA championship in 1987.
Yeah, what Pat Riley did was quite clever. So he predicted that they will win once again, and actually put the pressure. A, he put pressure on his players to win, and B, after a while, I think he made them believe that this is possible. And if you believe something is possible, you're going to put more effort into it. And indeed, they trained hard, and it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's true in our own lives, not in the athletes. So it's been shown that optimists earn more. And why do they earn more? So two economists at Duke University found that optimists work harder and longer hours. So if you think you're going to get ahead, you're just going to put the effort into it, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, that does not mean that everyone who expects to win are actually going to, right? That's kind of the essence of the optimism bias. But you're more likely to than if you don't have the faith.
I would assume that applies to students as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It applies to students. It applies to anyone, really. Imagining, you know, that you can get whatever you're after is makes it more likely.
It's been suggested that stereotypes are examples of self-fulfilling prophecies.
Yeah. So it's our expectations are formed not only, you know, from what we're not born with expectations. They're formed by what other people around us tell us we might expect as well. And stereotypes is really expectations of a lot of people around us of who we are and what we're going to do and what we're going to be. And if it's a negative expectation as well, that can have a negative impact on what we do and how we act and become, unfortunately, a self-fulfilling prophecy.
My guest is Tali Sharot, who is currently a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Center for Neuroimagining at the University College London. She's written a book called The Optimism Bias, a tour of the irrationally positive brain, published by Pantheon. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What did Dr. Sarah Bengston's study using the words clever and stupid tell us about the brain?
Yeah, that was a very interesting study. So the question that she wanted to ask is, how do expectations really affect our ability to learn? And what she did was she primed volunteers who came into the lab with either words such as smart, clever, or words such as stupid. And then she had the volunteers learn different cognitive tasks. And what she found was that if she primed them with the words smart and clever, they did better in the task, although there's no relevance. And if she primed them with the word stupid, they did worse. Now, interestingly enough, she found when she looked at the brain activation that when people were primed with the word smart and they had made an error, there was enhanced activation in parts of the frontal lobes, as if the signal was saying, oh, there's an error, which I did not expect. We have, you know, learned from this. However, if you prime someone with the word stupid and they made an error, well, the error was expected. And so there was no signal in the brain saying there's some kind of discrepancy here. Take notice. And so the people didn't learn as much. And this is quite, I think, what probably happens to us in life. You know, if we expect to do well and we don't, then we take notice.
Ross left this comment on Facebook. He said, I've always thought that if I think I'm optimistic, I must really deep down be expecting something worse.
So if he thinks he's optimistic, he's expecting something worse?
I guess he thinks he's compensating for that fear. I don't know how that fits in with what you just said, but I thought I'd read it to you anyway. How did the election of Barack Obama affect global optimism?
Yeah, it's interesting. So we mentioned before that usually people are optimistic about themselves, but they're somewhat pessimistic about the country. Well, that's normally true until things become really difficult. When things become really difficult, such as the 2008 financial downfall or the Great Depression of the 1930s, at that point, something really interesting happens because people become optimistic not only about themselves, but about their country as well. And this is what happened around the time that Obama was elected. And so his message of hope was very much in accord with how people were feeling.
And now that's turned around completely, according to the polls.
Yeah, and it doesn't last for a long time. So usually people are pessimistic about the country. It's only when things suddenly become really bad that they become optimistic, and it doesn't last for very long. And the question is why? I think when things suddenly become very difficult, the only way people can imagine themselves getting out of the dump is taking the country with them. It's a kind of case, if the ship is going to sink, I'm going to sink with it.
What's the role of oxytocin in all of this?
Oxytocin is interesting because it seems to be a hormone that is involved in connecting between individuals. So it's related to the connection between mother and child. It's also connected to the relationship between people in romantic relationships. And there is some suggestion that we have enhanced oxytocin in us wherein we feel what John Haidt at the UC Berkeley says is elevation. So when we have this feeling of elevation, we have more of that hormone. This is yet to be tested.
Now, related to this is the sense of happiness, isn't it? Everybody says, I just want to be happy.
So it's interesting. I was asked the other day, what do I think? What's more important for our happiness? What we experience at the moment or what we think we're going to experience in the future? And I gave this example. Imagine that you're having a lovely dinner with your friends and family, but you know that tomorrow you're about to go to prison. How happy are you going to be? Not very happy. Now imagine that you're in a prison cell, it's dark and wet, but you know that tomorrow you're going to be released and you're going to be with your friends and family. How happy are you going to be? Quite happy. Now, this does not mean that what we're experiencing at the moment doesn't matter for our happiness. It does. But what we expect to be experiencing in the future has a huge, huge impact.
Well, if we ask somebody not in prison or about to go to prison, but just your every average person, for a list of what would make them happy. Can we pretty much predict what would be on that list?
Yeah, we can predict what will be on that list, but their predictions of what will make them happy seems to be quite wrong. So people tend to think that more money will make them happier. This does not seem to be the case when you actually look at the evidence. More money usually does not make you happy unless it really changes from, you know, having absolutely none in very worst cases. People suggest that think that traveling will make them happier.
Having children? Getting married?
Yes, I think that having children, getting married. With respects to getting married, what people find is that it doesn't have an effect one way or the other, but probably the reason is that for some people it enhances their happiness and some it doesn't, so at the end the effect is neutral. With having children, so far it seems that your momentary happiness is not necessarily enhanced, but maybe it enhances your satisfaction, overall satisfaction with life.
Are we happier being the richest of our friend among our friends, or having a significant amount more than most people, but less than the people around us?
Yeah, what's important is not how much you actually have. It's how much you have relative to the people around you. So everything is really relative. I guess people are happier when they think they're doing better than what the baseline is.
Well, we've been talking about optimism, but what about the opposite and a sense of helplessness? What was Martin Seligman's trying to find out by giving shocks to confined dogs? And I'm not sure I want to bring this up and without because I'm slightly afraid somebody from PETA is listening and is going to be very upset that I even mentioned this.
Right. Well, optimism is very much related to depression, which is what Martin Seligman ended up finding. What we find is that people with mild depression tend to be more accurate in the prediction of the future than healthy individuals. So About 80% of the population have an optimism bias, and the rest, 20%, don't. Out of those, a really large percent seem to be depressed. And mildly depressed people can predict the future better than healthy individuals. However, people with severe depression seem to have a pessimistic bias, so they expect the future to be worse than it ends up being.
Well, he learned what would make dogs feel helpless, but then he also taught dogs to unlearn it. Can we unlearn?
Yeah, so what Martin Seligman found was that control is quite important. And if we have a sense of control of the environment, we have a sense of control that we can steer the wheel in the right direction for the future, then we expect things to be better, right? But if you think you don't have control, well, anything is random, and then you don't know if things are going to get better or not. So control, and a sense of control, is very important for optimism.
Well, you mentioned the prisoner about to be released, and I'm thinking about control as well, as a reason that people prefer Friday to Sunday.
Yeah, that's an interesting...
Because the weekend is more under our control than... weekdays when
I never thought about it like that. Is it more under control? Maybe. Yeah, it's true. When you ask people to list the days of the week that they prefer, so the one that they prefer most is Saturday, but after that it's Friday, and only after that is Sunday. And this is quite surprising. Why would people prefer Friday over Sunday, right? Friday is a working day and Sunday is a day to relax, so it doesn't really make sense. So here's why. On Friday, people have this expectation of the weekend, all the wonderful things they're going to do or not going to do. However, on Sunday, they have the expectations of the week ahead and all the things that they need to accomplish in the week. And again, this is how anticipation of what's coming affects our happiness in the moment.
A caller has asked, how does your guest account for freedom? It sounds like this theory is based on an idea of pure determinism.
He means our...
It sounds like, I guess, everything is about the chemistry in our body, the way our brains are structured.
Free will. So he's asking about free will. Okay.
And it's never been determined whether there is such a thing as free will.
Yeah, well, it really matters on how we define it. And, you know, I see the human behavior... I'm a materialist, so I think everything, of course, is, you know, we have cells in our body and our brain, and the structures in our brain determine our behavior. That doesn't mean that we can't make choices. And the question is, who's making choices? Well, we are our brain and we are our cells, and so we can definitely make the choices.
And are we more likely to make different choices depending on whether we are optimistic or pessimistic?
I think that's true. You know, if you think you can have that job that you want, the relationship that you want, you're then going to make the choice to take the action to do it. And what you see is that people who are very much pessimistic, so especially depressed individuals, they tend to act less. And they, you know, if you don't think there's something out there for you to find, you're not even going to get out of bed and try to find it.
My guest has been Tali Sharot. Her book, The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain, published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.